Hi, I'm Lauren Edmonds. I'm the founder and owner of a school that supports children with learning delays. I'm hoping the space gives you something to think about.
I want to talk about oppositional behavior, but before I do that, I also want to acknowledge that I don't often talk about diagnoses and remedial space, or if I do, it's in a context of something broader. And there's quite a good reason for that, is because I find that while getting a diagnosis can be a relief and can be empowering, it can also, if we're not careful, place children into a box. And then we as a community of therapists, teachers, and parents can address the box and not the child. So I'm very cautious to separate out children that are seemingly neurotypical and surviving or thriving, and separating that group, or calling them a group, from a separate subgroup which seems to be neurodivergent and not thriving. And while I recognize neurodivergent children can be thriving, that's the point. But let me talk into oppositional defiance and demand avoidance and aggression and behaviors that we struggle with when it comes to kids that seemingly also come with diagnoses like autism and ADHD, etc. Now, a few years ago, they talked about comorbidity. And the idea around this was, if we viewed all these different diagnoses, including OCD and anxiety and sleep disorders, they put them all on a page, they could connect them all like a web. And they called them comorbid because they saw them often occurring together. Now, that's very interesting for me, because if something on a regular basis occurs with something else, it enhances the story. It doesn't make it a bigger burden. It actually gives us more insight. So 13 years ago, when I started my school, when I started Amatus, there wasn't a specific diagnosis called ODD. It came about, I think, and I stand to be corrected, around 10 years ago. And it may or may not be in the DSM. I'm not a psychologist. I don't necessarily follow that because it's not necessarily of interest to me. But ODD is oppositional defiance disorder. Then more recently, in the last 3 to 4 years, PDA has been a diagnosis that's followed a child, and I see it following it to me, pathological demand avoidance. And I'm not too sure if it's a diagnosis since it's in the DSM. I think it isn't yet, but the word yet is quite telling as well. But I want to see it in this comorbid space, in this web space, in this linked space of where children are operating, and how we see diagnosis and how we often see it as a layered thing. So our child gets an ADHD diagnosis and we come somewhat relieved, but it's also quite a heavy burden. But it's still not right, and we get medication for it, but it doesn't quite work. And then we see some other behaviors and we go into our doctor's office, and then perhaps we get an autism diagnosis. And this is all just conjecture. This is just a story I'm playing out to talk to the child, not the diagnosis. Because then if what our intervention that we put in place through therapists and schooling and our own parenting style doesn't work per se, we might visit the doctor and we might get an OCD or an ODD or a PDA diagnosis. And all of this is just another part of the same story, as opposed to being layered on. But it often feels, from a parenting point of view, like it's another layer, another thing that we have to deal with. Oh my gosh, he or she also has this now. And when we view it like that, we often view it as separate from anything else. We want to address it separately. And it actually is, it's all just the same story about the same child potentially getting worse, that child getting worse, not being able to cope, or being able to cope less and less and less. So therefore, these other coping mechanisms are coming out. So this is where, for me, the key lies is, are these things behaviors that are children trying to survive and cope? Now, there is no doubt that the research is showing us a neuro-non-typical. They're showing us that there are many brains that work in a way that don't fit the standard mold we've been assuming for the last 30, 40 years. Okay, fine. I think the shift needs to be away from we have neurotypical and then everybody else. I think everybody is neurodiverse. We've just only been catering for what we saw to be the neurotypical brain. And many children are actually not thriving in that neurotypical environment because they're not neurotypical. Just thriving enough for no one to be alarmed. But that perhaps is another discussion. What I really want to talk about is when your child is being oppositional or defiant, what does that look like? When internalized to a person, it looks like self-harm. Sometimes we see it as self-destructive behavior. Sometimes we don't see it because it's just the way they speak to themselves, how they refer to themselves, they internalize their pain. Or are we seeing it as external behavior where they're showing aggression towards others, they're resisting us, they're becoming physical? Both of those things, if you look at the child in the most positive light and you think, this child, this human being, is designed to survive. They're designed to protect themselves, to find connection, to thrive. They're designed, well, maybe not to thrive, but they're designed to survive in their environment. Then the question we ask ourselves is, what about the environment is causing them to behave like this in order to survive? Why is this behavior something that their system feels is necessary in order to cope with their environment? What is wrong with the environment? Now, it's human nature, I think, for a large amount of people, to look external when we talk about the environment. So parents will often look to the school is not the right place, the teacher is not the right place. And while that could very well be the case, I don't think that's always the place to start, because then we villainize the very system that we need in order to send our children to. And I'm not necessarily the best person to be backing the system up, because my own daughter was rejected by the system and told to get out and find another place because they couldn't cater for her, which was crazy for me. I mean, this is now we're going back 15, 16, 17 years, but it was crazy that the education system would kick out a child and say, go and find a place elsewhere, because they're the system that's supposed to be helping. And what do? You end up on your own. So I'm not in favor of saying the school is never wrong, but I am in favor of saying to every single person listening is the only person you can change and affect is yourself. And as you change and affect yourself or impact yourself, the impact is then placed on others. It impacts others because you are the environment for other people. So when your child has got a PDA or an ODD or any kind of oppositional bad behavior, naughty boy, naughty girl sort of label over them, the first thing I want you to do is breathe and think, okay, I'm so lucky that I am being shown the behavior that it's not hidden inside my child, that they were outwardly demonstrating some things that are seeable, knowable, feelable by others, perceived by others, and I'm getting this feedback. Great. Okay. My child is not okay. Now what? There's so many resources you can go to, and I hope you go to the right ones. There's books you can read. If you follow Gordon Newfield's work around hold on to your children, if you follow Gabor Mate's work around trauma, if you follow Becky Bailey's work around conscious discipline, there's so many positive approaches that you can start to slowly incorporate into your parenting style that gives your child the space. Now, I used to advocate educational psychology, which I still do. But the limitation there is the psychologist is mandated to deal with an individual. So they deal with the child and they give feedback to the parent. But what I'm seeing is that the ecosystem needs to change. So we need to be working with the parent at the same time. And I don't really want separate people dealing with separate elements in the home. How wonderful is it that we have social workers? Because they're mandated to work at a family level. So I'm referring always to a social worker that's a clinical social worker that works with play therapy, works with attachment, and she works with parents and children and the relationship they have to heal that space. Because in healing that space, you can start to heal the other environments and spaces the child is in and you are in as well. The family unit is the most important ecosystem a child will experience. It's where they learn their value system. It's where they learn how to be safe. It's where they learn how to be in the world and evolve and become who they need to be. If you're lucky, you have a school system that understands that and supports that as well and isn't trying to change your child or fix your child. They're trying to make a safe space for your child so they can, as with the family home, feel safe in who they are, express who they are, build the skills and develop into exactly who they're meant to be, and not somebody different, not somebody without a diagnosis. I always say, if you've got a dyslexia diagnosis, for example, you're always going to be dyslexic. You're either going to be a high-functioning one or a low-functioning one. And how do we get your kids to be high-functioning dyslexics as opposed to children who beat themselves up and cause problems, which cause them to be disciplined harshly, which cause further problems, which cause them to be extricated from their environment? I mean, that's what we practice conscious discipline. We practice restorative justice, because the last thing we need is for children to be pulled further and further out of their community. And by taking a child out of a mainstream school and putting them in a small school like mine, you're already giving the image of you don't belong here, you have to go over there. So it's a huge, big focus of ours to help children to feel like they belong. Not that they fit in, it's a very different thing, but that they belong who they are, and that their opposition and avoidance behavior is not who they are. It's how they're surviving. And we've got to acknowledge that, and we've got to respect that this child has wisdom, that they know what they need to do in order to survive their day. And in a school space that isn't triggering them all the time, that actually is emotionally, psychologically, and physically safe, they learn, their nervous system learns, that they don't have to avoid and oppose in order to keep themselves safe. That they will be allowed to feel their emotions. They will be allowed to be angry. They'll be allowed to be scared. And in those moments, we give their nervous system what they need: soothing, regulation, safety. You're safe with us. I know you're behaving badly, and we don't like that behavior because that's hurting somebody else. But I'm right here, and you're going to be okay, and we're going to find another way. And isn't that beautiful? Rather than moving into a diagnosis space where we all feel so on edge and panicked, and our own nervous systems as adults are feeling triggered, and what now, and what's going to happen, and what's next, and how do I walk this back, and who do I really want my child to be? And the problem with all of this is we start to get used to who our children are, and then we start treating them like that, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We treat them the way we are experiencing them, so they become more of that and they don't get to walk it back. So our job is really to be regulated, to see our children for who they are, to give them grace in their behavior, to recognize their behavior, to observe it and recognize their behavior as communication, understand and hear the communication at a deeper level, at a causation level. Then how do we address the cause? One thing we do as a school is we never want to get the symptom to go away. We never want to suppress the symptom. The only time we work harder at the symptom than we do at the cause is when the symptom is self-destructive or destructive of other children. But we want to try and keep those symptoms in place because that is the measure we can see. If we squash that behavior and punish that behavior away, the cause is still there. It then comes out as another symptom that we don't recognize, perhaps. We want to be able to see what's going on. Then we work at a causation level, because when we stop what is causing the need for them to be destructive, when we address the right thing, we will know we've found the right thing because the symptom goes away, because the behavior goes away. We don't want to manage the behavior. We want to observe the behavior. We want to manage the cause. And I think this is very, very true for oppositional defiance and pathological demand avoidance and any other label you want to place on a child's behavior that we feel might be uncomfortable for us or not appropriate in society. We need to give grace, and then we need to work on the cause.